Warning, the following ZipRecruiter radio spot you are about to hear is going to be filled with F-words.
When you're hiring, we at ZipRecruiter know you can feel frustrated, forlorn even, like your efforts are futile, and you can spend a fortune trying to find fabulous people, only to get flooded with candidates who are just fine. Fortunately, ZipRecruiter figured out how to fix all that. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ziprecruiter.com/zip. With ZipRecruiter, you can forget your frustrations because we find the right people for your roles fast, which is our absolute favorite F word. In fact, 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day.
Fantastic.
So, whether you need to hire 4, 40, or 400 people, get ready to meet first-rate talent. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/zip to try ZipRecruiter for free. Don't forget, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. Finally, that's ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
The deeper we continue to dive into the case of Brian Koberger, seems more questions continue to emerge about this case. It seemed, you know, fairly cut and dry, and maybe it is. But there's a lot of things on the line here, especially with the discovery of unidentified male DNA at the crime scene. The prosecution remains focused on Koberger's alleged involvement. The defense is, of course, pushing hard to basically exploit these unknown DNA samples to suggest alternative possibilities. Does this really change the strength of the case against Koberger, or is this just a classic defense strategy to create reasonable doubt? To help us break this down from a behavioral and an investigative standpoint, we are joined by retired FBI Special Agent Robin Drake, former chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Robin, let's start here on all of this. You have investigated all sorts of different types of behavior on some of the highest levels. How much weight should we be putting on this with the discovery of unknown DNA at the crime scene? And is this something that could legitimately point to another suspect? Or is this just the defense, you know, doing their job, muddying the waters, as Ann Taylor, we know, is very good at?
It's kind of scary, actually, Tony. Listening to Howard Bloom again, who wrote the book On When Night Comes Falling last week on another show, and I've listened to him a bunch. I've read his book, and I've followed this case with you from the very beginning. And at the very beginning of this case, with the DNA on the night sheaf, I was really, really highly confident. And again, I'm still confident in my own opinion that, you know, Koberger is the one that did this. But there's something he did at the very, very beginning, and I even commented it on with you like 2 years ago now, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That was it. It always struck me. Remember, I said at the very beginning, he looked to have the impression of someone who was shocked mm-hmm. that he was caught.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, even his first words, if I'm recollecting right, were something to the effect of like, are you looking at anyone else?
Yeah.
Something to that effect when he's arrested. And even when looking at him in the courtroom, he always had that appearance of someone who looked like he failed the high school final exam and was shocked that he did because he had prepared so well for it.
Mm-hmm.
And then what Howard Bloom put out as his own conjecture and own theory with the discovery of this other blood and DNA, which is unknown at this point who it's from, and that's problematic as well, is that there was some found on the banister in the house and then some found in a glove outside the house. And what Howard Bloom is putting out there as his conjecture and theory is that that's actually planted by Koberger. And if so, that then reinforces my own conjecture at the beginning that he was shocked that he was actually caught, because he actually and I was a little inaccurate, I think, in my beginning. You know, I said at the very beginning of this case that, you know, he was a novice at this, and he is a novice. He didn't have any reps, and that I thought he's a little sloppier than a seasoned serial killer would be. But at the same time, though, if this is actually true, that he actually staged the crime like this and actually had the forethought to do that, that was brilliant on his part. Because what it's doing is it's giving Ann Taylor plausible deniability that there potentially could be someone else out there. And the fact that they cannot find or identify who that blood came from, especially with the glove outside the house, that's problematic. And then we have the problem of the FBI apparently did a lousy job of getting the authority to actually look at the DNA databases that they did, which were privately held ones, not the big ones, mm-hmm. that could actually get that DNA evidence thrown out, and anything that they used subsequent to that fruit of the poison tree. So there's some issues here that I'm concerned about.
Let's talk about the glove and the blood that was on the banister, and that's a very interesting point to make. I haven't heard that one yet. And you said Howard had this one initially?
Okay. Howard had that, yeah.
So the idea is, Koberger being the criminology student, he has this idea on, okay, how to set up a crime scene. He's, you know, learned about it, but not a lot of, or really no real world experience. So you're kind of going off of what could you figure out here? And really not a bad idea if you're going to go kill people, of be that prepared and have it already point to somebody else. But okay, question one, where do you get somebody else's blood like this to put onto a crime scene? And it's two different males, from what we understand, on a railing or a banister, and then outside in a glove. How do you go about doing that? What are the logistics you think that it would take to get that? Because I don't know. I'm not a killer, but I also don't know off the top of my head how I'm going to go gather someone's blood to put on this sort of stuff.
Yeah, I honestly don't know, because I've never yeah. heard of it before either. And the other big thing that this still prosecution has to get over and has having a problem with is that there was so much blood left behind in that house from the murders themselves. I mean, as he was describing, and the other investigators were, I mean, it was coming through the walls, because, you know, four beautiful young people murdered with a knife in such a short amount of time, there's a vast amount of blood everywhere. Yet they tore that car apart, and his car had not a stitch of blood. There wasn't a drop of blood anywhere. Mm-hmm. Anywhere on his clothes, on his person, in his vehicle, in his apartment, anywhere. So that is, again, when you kind of put those two things together, it's he did a really good job, again, if it's him. And the other thing, though, that now kind of, that's the bad news. The good news, though, that is still on prosecution side, is when they went to his house to arrest and search the house, his behavior when they actually walked in, of him bagging up his own personal DNA evidence in his trash bags and then put in a neighbor's trash, that's very, very damning behavioral evidence. But man.
Yeah, I mean, one would, yeah, that the very odd with the whole bagging up the evidence and then, you know, going and putting it in the neighbor's trash. That was always a creepy thing. I mean, is it impossible to think, though? I mean, yes, obviously, with the amount of blood that was at this scene, if you're the killer, you'd almost inevitably have to have some on you, would you not? In some way, shape, or form, and then for that to transfer to a vehicle, I would think be pretty easy. Unless you take off whatever you're wearing and that's gone. And then, I don't know, I'm wondering how far ahead was he thinking in this? And maybe a lot more than we've been giving credit for, if in fact he is the guy.
Yeah, well, a lot of forethought and planning was going into that. Again, if what the prosecution is claiming is accurate, you know, with the amount of times that the vehicle was in the area, his lack of contact with the victims themselves was also potentially intentional. I mean, there's a lot of intentionality that he did along the way. I mean, just think about this. If that one mistake of the knife sheath wasn't left behind and the one molecule of a touch DNA wasn't on it, we would have no idea that Koberger had anything to do with this.
And it also makes you wonder, who else would they be looking at if the only DNA that was found was the blood or the glove? Right. And if they would run that through a database and take a look at that. Do you know, have they tried to identify this other than just the, you know, the CODIS database? I mean, obviously they went to the third party ones, the ancestry type ones and things of that nature to narrow in on Koberger. But if they have these other two pieces, why not, I guess, why not take a look there too in the same sort of way?
I'd imagine that they have done that, and but there's nothing to find, you know, because again, it's, the database is only good as people that submit their things to it. And again, if this was forethought on Koberger's part, he's going to ensure that wherever he got that blood, it's going to be someone who's actually not in the database.
Because
again, he was a student of the craft, there is no doubt. But again, without the life reps and experience, so there were missteps that were only evident after he made the one blunder of the Night Chief again. So it's where he got that blood, or where that blood, whether it's him or, you know, if that conjecture is right on Howard's part or anyone else, that's a big mystery. There is no doubt. That was a big revelation that came about.
Well, I remember early on we did hear about the blood here in the Koberger case, that there was other DNA, maybe not necessarily blood, but we know we heard the term DNA was found within the house. And everybody just kind of said, yeah, it's a party house. People come and go out of there all the time. And we know that they did. So if you're going to plant evidence, as Howard is suggesting, to try and lead someone somewhere else, why not put it in a far more obvious area, like by the bodies or something, not over on a railing that's far away from where this even took place, or outside where, I mean, a snowplow could get it. There's a lot of ways that that could be picked up or just not even really considered much of anything. That to me, just, it doesn't seem to add up. Maybe I think as strong as Howard thinks it does.
Maybe.
No.
I'm not so convinced that the blood on the banister in the house was forethought, because that's a hard one to pick up, or, you know, takes a little more planning, I would think. But a glove outside, that kind of might fit a pattern, only because, you know, in the heat of chaos like he was in, and to be in such chaos that you leave a knife sheath behind of the murder weapon, and maybe as you're heading out the door, you're like, oh yeah, I gotta leave the glove, boom, and then you run, you know. So, and also you want to leave it, I would think that you'd leave it in a conspicuous place. But again, right next to the bodies would be a lot more conspicuous. But maybe he thought, you know, if I left, again, pure conjecture.
Yeah, yeah.
But if there's so much blood, you don't want the blood of the victims overwhelming the blood that he wanted to be found in the glove. He's going to leave it in a place that is a little easier to have maintain its cleanliness and sterile environment for what he was intentionally wanting it to do in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
Again, a lot of way out conjecture.
Yeah, sure.
But it was an interesting theory that he put forward that I hadn't thought of before as well. Or it's just, like they said, it's a party house with a lot of stupid things that happened in it over time. But again, the glove of the blood was the interesting one.
And here's the thing with that, and this is just kind of my thoughts. Really nothing to do with the case, just life experience, having lived in college towns before, having gone for walks, you know, around the area in a snowy atmosphere, you know, similar to what this would have been on a cold day, or just a cold environment. You could probably go for a walk right now and I can find a glove within an hour somewhere. Or less, you know, especially if it's really cold. You go for it, like, you'd see that stuff sitting around in places. And if you have anything on your fingers, anything on your hands, the smallest cut, the smallest scrape, whatever, that's going to certainly get into your glove. I mean, I cook all the time, so I always have like a little nick here and there. So pretty much all my gloves are going to have a little piece of blood on there, I'm sure, somewhere, if you really were to identify it. And again, the odds of just finding a glove outside, probably fairly good in an environment like that.
Yeah, I'm with you. But when you're Ann Taylor,
and, yeah,
you know, defense, and you're going for reasonable doubt, and a jury's got to convict for a firing squad potential, that's all she needs.
Yeah, and I mean,
that might be enough.
Is this a play from Ann Taylor that you think could go all the way to letting him walk free, or is this more of a play of it's reasonable enough doubt to not kill him if he is in fact found guilty?
I think both, potentially, because she's making a play on both the glove as a theory of that there was someone else involved. If not someone else involved, it was someone else not Koberger entirely, and also going for the fruit of the poisonous tree about how they found it was Koberger's DNA to begin with, because that was done without... again, the interesting thing about that, again, going back to the DNA,
yeah,
it wasn't illegal what the FBI did to go into a privately owned database for DNA.
Mm-hmm.
It was just against the policy of the company. And so, in other words, if you had a friend inside, you know, 23andMe, it wasn't 23andMe that did, I can't remember, Ancestry.com, I think is the
yeah.
one pinged on it. You know, if you had a friend inside of Ancestry.com and you had DNA and you said, hey, buddy, can you just check this out for me?
Mm-hmm.
That would break company policy, but there's really no legal liability to you. But
yeah.
when the FBI is involved, there's a lot of things I couldn't do in the way of my investigative tools and resources as an FBI agent that me as a private citizen I could. Like, for example, I without specific authorities and permissions, again, this was a number of years ago and things might have changed, but because I retired in 2018. If I had an individual that I was doing a behavioral assessment on,
mm-hmm.
there's nothing better than video. Getting video of the people that we're going to strategize a recruitment operation of, an interview strategy of, or something else, going on YouTube or Facebook or any other social media platform to gather information so I could strategize putting together a great conversation and how to inspire trust and hopefully elicit a confession or whatever it is I was going for, it would be a great tool and resource. I was precluded from it. Unless I had specific permissions and or NSLs involved, you know, national security letters involved, because it was considered a database that even though it was public domain, there was a lot of legal things, policy things that I was precluded from doing that average Joe citizen couldn't. So kind of going then back to the problem with the DNA, that the FBI was accessing a database it wasn't allowed to access in furtherance of this case. Again, it wasn't breaking a law. Is breaking a policy. From what I understand, again, I'm getting this
yeah.
through Howard Bloom's interpretation of everything.
Does that affect anything, though, in court? I mean, if you're not breaking a law, yes, you're breaking a policy. That's something that would be handled, I would think, you know, interdepartmentally, not necessarily in the court of law. If for some reason, again, this is the database with DNA, so they kind of had to have it to do the search. But if somebody else were to do this search on this, who's not in the FBI, and they came back to the FBI and said, hey, look what I found using this. And it's pretty interesting, pretty much leads you to sort someone. You couldn't take that information then from that person, or could you take it, but you can't do anything with it?
Oh, Tony, you get into a really, really fascinating area here. So I don't know the legal, you know, the I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know the actual legal things of this, but the judge is the one that's going to be deciding all this, and that's why Ann Taylor's making a push for this. But you brought up an interesting thought experiment here, because I dealt with this a lot. We could not, and I could not, for my confidential human sources I had, and that's what you're alluding to, is a confidential human source. Some people call them snitches,
yeah. you know,
insiders, whatever they are. I could not overtly task them to do things that were illegal, because you need attorney general authority to do otherwise illegal activity, it's called, or I couldn't task them to do things that were unethical, immoral. There's a whole litany of things I could not task someone to do and ask someone to do on my behest, because I couldn't. It was against our operating guidelines.
Sure.
But if someone proactively, unsolicited, brought me information, well, I could use that.
Okay.
And then I had to be able then to articulate that I didn't task them. And so it gets in that gray area. And who's going to challenge it and not challenge it? So, yeah, it's a funky area in there.
Well, and who else is going to have access to the DNA in this sort of a case? So it's right. kind of a moot point in this specific one, because the only people who would have it would be investigators. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's different things, I get it. But it's a strange area. The thing is, though, with this case, I know, obviously, Ann Taylor doing her job. Again, as we've said many a times, if something happens, you want her representing you, yep. because she's doing a very good job of it. But the prosecution is still saying, and? Like, it's a party house. You're going to have it on a railing. It's not like the blood that was found in these places are odd places to find traces of blood or DNA at all. They're very normal spots where one could assume it could go. You hold onto a handrail when you walk up and down the stairs. You put a glove on. And if you have a cut or something, which probably a large percentage of people continually do, it's going to be there. It's not, but a knife sheath to have your touch DNA on that of the murder weapon. That seems to be a hell of a lot stronger than they found a glove out front with some DNA that they don't know whose it is.
Yep. Yep. And that's the sort of strength of the case is really hinging on that knife sheath and the touch DNA on the thumb snap. But then it goes back to, did he just happen? Again, this is where they're throwing the conjecture out there of what the fence might do, Ann Taylor might do, is, you know, he knew potentially the people that, you know, bought the knife, and he touched it, or he touched it at the place that they bought it from, you know, while he's looking at it at a store one time. I mean, so again, throwing lots of darts at the plausible deniability here. Again, a stretch in a lot of it, no doubt. But if you keep poking holes and causing some reasonable doubt, it's enough to might save his life.
Well, and that's obviously for a jury to decide. Shall we get there at some point in time? There's obviously other big pieces to this case beyond just the touch DNA. You know, we're taking a look now at they have been looking at the triangulation of the cell phone data, and a lot of that does point to him going in and around the house several times prior to the actual murders. They believe he went by the house right after the murders in the morning. And that's just some of the few pieces we know on this very, very sealed up case. They went in, they took all of his digital devices. I'm sure, examined all of them as deeply as they can possibly get. That information still has not been put out there. We don't know what they found, and I'm sure we'll find that out at trial. I'm going to think they probably found some stuff. I have no idea. That's what we still have to find out. But I mean, that would be very interesting. Would you be shocked if there's nothing on any of his devices that point to anything to do with this case?
Yeah, I don't think there will be.
Really?
I think he's pretty thorough because the leakage we're getting, matter of fact, one of the things they also brought up during the interview with Howard was how disappointed he was that the prosecution didn't have pushback on any of these things Ann Taylor was claiming. Mm-hmm. They kind of let it ride, and there was still nothing new that came out. So she's poking a lot of holes in the cell phone theory stuff too, just because of how small that town is and how, you know, the cell phone data could be there or it could be 10 miles away. That's what they're saying. So again, and he is what's interesting about this, he is an all in, it was definitely Koberger guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and no doubt in his mind, but he is seeing what Ann Taylor is doing to poke all the holes in it as she can, and what it looks like is she is, again, my conjecture, she's capitalizing on what he did to intentionally mislead people, and she's doing a really good job of it. And so I'd be, boy, the tiny attorney client privilege on this would be interesting to listen to, wouldn't it? Because I wonder what he's leading her to based on what his knowledge of the scene was. Boy, that'd be fascinating.
That would be very fascinating to hear what exactly that'll be one of those things where it'll come out on cassette tapes later and we'll all be dead and our kids will hear it.
I just got my fingers crossed, Tony, that it doesn't go south on us because these four beautiful young kids that were murdered bloodless, with a lot of violence, a lot of rage, meaninglessly, all to satisfy some moron that was trying to get off.
His mental health records, Brian Koberger's mental health records, have now been also turned over to the prosecution on this. You know, from a standpoint of, you know, behavioral analysis, what do you think the prosecution is looking for on this? And, you know, what could they use in their case? And let's also throw it on the other side. And what could the defense use on their case? I mean, obviously, depending on what's in those records.
In my opinion, again, not knowing legally what they can use or not use, I actually think that helps prosecution because from what we've even seen in leakage in social media with the postings he was doing at an earlier age, as a teenager, all the challenges he's had throughout his life, he's got an arc of behavior that says it was escalating to something like this potentially. Because not all crazy broken brains do this, but all people that do this have a crazy broken brain and a life arc to get there. And so he's got a lot of telltale signs from what we've heard, at least in social media, that would lead them to see that. So having prosecution access to those mental health records, I think, is going to help prosecution.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't necessarily make a killer by any means if somebody had trouble in life and have some mental health problems. Obviously, you know, I think everybody does to a certain extent, but obviously not everyone goes and kills people on that. So I'm wondering how far back those records are going to make much of a difference in this case. Are we going to go all the way back to the teen years where he was writing online allegedly about the visuals snow and feeling disconnected emotionally from his loved ones and not knowing what to do or feel about that? I mean, that's a kind of a big one, I would think, in terms of showing lack of empathy or lack of feeling. And also, all the people that he's interacted with, there was complaints. There was a lot of issues from a lot of former students and coworkers of this guy's just... there's something missing here. He's off. He's very cold. He doesn't seem to actually connect on a human level. But again, how do you take that into court and how do you argue that to show that this is also the character of a killer?
So those are a couple different things, I think. I think the testimony of people in his life is going to be different than the health records. Mm-hmm. Health records, I think, is just going to go back to whenever he was first professionally seen by someone for whatever he's dealing with, and potentially also dealing with the drug addiction as well, whether he got professional help for that as well in recovery. Again, I don't know what's going to be admissible or not admissible, but I think those things are actually the ones leading towards that life arc. Yeah, from what I've, because again, reading the book on him and his family and his dad, I mean, there's a lot of caring in this family about trying to help him throughout his life. And so when you try to help someone, there's a lot of records of people trying to help someone. So he wasn't someone that was cast out by his family at mm-hmm. all. And so it's heartbreaking as a parent to look at what as much effort as his dad put in to save him didn't work out that well. Obviously, but I think there's going to be a lot of records for it.
I mean, very much, yeah. Like it's a broken brain. If in fact this is him that did do this, with having all those people, feeling that way about him. Obviously, the investigators came in. They caught him packaging up his stuff into baggies and trying to put it into the neighbor's trash. We still don't really know exactly what was in those baggies. What was he trying to package up? Why was he trying to put it into the trash? There's so many unknowns here in this case that we still do not know about. What are some of the pieces that you're most curious about once this reaches trial that you want some answers to that I'm sure the investigators have, and I'm sure it's out there in discovery this way or that way, but what are some of those pieces to you that you think could really make or break this?
So definitely what was in those trash baggies, obviously. And outside of what we were already seeing, the typical behaviors of someone that does something like this, there was a certain amount of stalking that takes place. You know, you have to actually do surveillance. They're going to be obsessing. They're going to be, he's a student. Students don't do things without notes, and so I would be really, really interested to see in what we don't know yet, as you're saying, and that's a digital footprint angle. You know, he might have done a good job of covering his tracks, but at some point I would have thought that he would have taken notes, he would have journaled, he would have done something on this path. And so hopefully that we're going to see that when it comes to trial.
That's what I'm wondering about the most, is that the notes, digital footprint, and things of that nature. I know you said you think we're not going to find anything. I don't know. I wonder about that, again, because of just minds like this. And the one I'm thinking of right now would be the allegations against Rex Huerman. I mean, he literally mm-hmm. had notes of like, yeah. And it was the silliest things, too. I can't think of them specifically off the top of my head, but it was like, wash hands, just like basic things. Where, right. Like, why do you need a note on like, this is the step you need to take, you know, after this? And I'm wondering if we're going to find something like that here.
So it's a great comparison. Rex Huerman also had a lifetime of complacency because mm-hmm. he got really used to his lifestyle, and he acclimated his entire family to that lifestyle, and so it became part of their normal. And you get really, really lazy when you're living in normal. If this was Koberger, this is his most likely his first murder, hopefully, and that this was, and he had a lot more attention to detail because he was a student of this, and Huerman was just a practitioner of this. Mm-hmm. And also, though, the reason why I say that we have a probability of not having what we're hoping to find, which he definitely would have done, taking notes, having detailed plans, you know, he would have had to have had that to do what he did. But we still don't have blood, his blood on anything. We can't find clothes, no murder weapon. In other words, he was really, 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 really good at covering his own DNA tracks on from the crime scene itself. He probably would have done the same thing on his digital footprint, I would think.
My conjecture on that, though, is this. You can go into your Facebook account, Instagram, whatever it was that maybe he was using, if, in fact, he was stalking the girls or looking at them or whatever. And, yeah, you can delete your own history. You can delete messages. You can do that. And it deletes it, you know, from your device. It deletes it from what you're able to then access on your cloud. But, I mean, they got subpoenas into these companies where they can go back and look further than that. The data, I'm very much guessing, could still be there even if he thought he wiped it correctly. But it's, you know, it once it's on the cloud, it's out there in these companies. The info is still there. And if you really, really need it, there's ways of getting it through court orders.
Yes, if you know which ones to look for.
True.
If he purchased burner phones and cloned accounts for everything he was, in other words, he would have, if he had, was planning this for a long time in advance, and he bought a burner everything to do all this on, and then disposed of it in fictitious names, it'd be much harder to track down. The only way you could do that, again, I'm not on the tech side of this, would be you'd be looking for cell pings and Wi-Fi connectivity in his apartment that wasn't necessarily linked to his overt accounts. You'd be looking for the covert black accounts. Mm-hmm. Much more challenging for investigators. Again, we're way out there on the conjecture side. But if Howard Bloom is correct in his thoughts and opinions on this, you know, I wouldn't put it by him to do it to that level and extent. I mean, you know, criminals using burner phones, it's pretty common.
Sure.
And could he have used that kind of methodology to do his planning? Yeah, very much so. So we'll see.
Yeah, what was he doing?
I hope not.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. I mean, one would assume if you're stalking someone, you wouldn't be using your name. You wouldn't be on your own account. I would think you'd probably have some sort of fake account going on there. And then it would be very difficult to trace that back because there's millions of accounts created every single day on these platforms by bots and such where, you know, they go into the ether. It'd be almost impossible to find, you know, maybe who
and,
or what.
And also, Tony, I'm sorry to interrupt, you know, and also, and so let's go back also to think about him as a PhD student in criminology. You know, he studied how people were caught.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so this was a very common way that people got caught. And so it looked like, and that's why my initial thing when I saw him in a courtroom in his initial statements where he was surprised he was caught, because being a student of people that got caught, he would do all these things to prevent him from being caught by those same methodologies. Him knowing in advance that, hey, people like me keep notes, they journal, and they stalk people. I got to cover my tracks from doing that, so I'll need to do X, Y, and Z. People get caught because they leave blood traces, you know, in their vehicles and all these things, you know, and the murder weapon, all these things. So I need to cover my tracks there.
Do you think he was that smart, or do you think he just got really, really lucky? And now these little pieces are coming up, and Ann Taylor's going, look at this. And he'd be like, yes, that could totally be something, too. I mean, it. I don't know. I'm wondering if he is truly as wise as we're giving him credit for.
Wise is a combination of education and experience. That's mm-hmm. wisdom. I don't think he has any wisdom whatsoever. He's a broken brain moron. But he did have academic background, and so I think he was academically trying to cover his tracks. And let's see where it falls apart, because obviously it fell apart with the Night Chief.
Mm-hmm.
Where it didn't fall apart, again, and this is what Howard was saying, nonstop was about him covering the tracks with both the murder weapon, the coveralls that he purchased at a store, I think it was on Amazon, and then having no blood traces anywhere on feet, on shoes, outside. I mean, and how did he do that? Where did he do that? I mean, that was the amount of pre-thought and pre-planning was really extreme. I've never heard of it in another case where it was like that clean. It was that sterile that they couldn't. I mean, they said they tore that car. They tore apart the gas tank. They tore apart the brake lines.
Mm-hmm.
For him just pushing on the brake in the car. I mean, they tore that car completely apart to find something and found nothing. That was how. I mean, so.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a good question just in itself of whoever did this. How did anyone get out of that bloody of a crime scene that you'd have to be that intimate with people on, meaning that close to be doing this stabbing and to not have anything on you and to not leave a trace of leaving? Yeah. I mean, anybody, like, there's just not, it's like no one came in some ways where it happened, but there's no evidence of necessarily someone coming in or leaving anything going out. That to me is also baffling. Take Koberger out of the equation. Whoever did that, like, that's somebody had some skills there, or again, insanely lucky. I don't know.
Yeah, unless he used it even a different vehicle. It's the only thing I thought of as well. And they're looking at analyzing his route that he took. He also the Snake River, one of the rivers he drove by, could have dumped stuff in there. But they've been, law enforcement scouring the rivers. They've been scouring the entire area. Howard had a theory of maybe they put it up. Maybe he hit up instead of everyone's looking down on the earth for mm-hmm. it. Maybe he put it up in a tree. I mean, there's all kinds of crazy conjecture on what he could have done to hide the usually the most telling part of any crime is that
mm-hmm.
and that is what's completely missing from this.
Yeah, so many questions, and we have a long ways to go before this hits the courtroom, and I think anything is still possible.
Very true.
The world of true crime never stops, and neither do we. Press subscribe now to get daily updates, in-depth analysis, and expert opinions from the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today.